Over. This is Channel 1, over. This is Channel 1, over on the new Rio Barbara 2. This is Channel 1, over. This is Channel 1, over on the new Rio Barbara 2. This is Channel 1, over. This is Channel 1, over. This is Channel 1, over on the new Rio Barbara 2. This is Channel 1, over. This is Channel 1, over on the new Rio Barbara 2. This is Monday 20, what is this? 20, how much? 27th of October, 69, breakfast. This is Monday, the 27th, 69, at breakfast, Channel 1 over. Channel 1 over. This is Channel 1 over. Monday, the 27th of October, 69.
Yeah, those bulls, I don't know why they have more personality, or just somehow or other, just handle them. Sooner or later, of course, they handle more. They handle individually, and the heifers never are. But some of those heifers have just been beautiful, Fay. Just
yeah.
Charming. Now, those articles from the Ocala Sabana that Lois gave me, that's right, they're right circumstantial. I like to look at them. Oh, he sticks in little, you know, about the horse industry in Marion County. That's, I could dispense with that. But now, he has his study, Dr. Fager, who's, they take him off the track right in his prime, 4 or 5 years old, and they have to unwind him. And the groom goes out in the paddock with him, and he says, with any horse, ordinary stallion, if you go out like that, he might not get back alive. Now, that's his attitude, you see, towards stallions. That's the way I always felt.
That's the way too many people feel. It's what often makes things like that. Because people think that they're going to be like that, they treat them like that, like the groom at Sunshine Stud. And he's a perfect example of what's going to make a stallion vicious.
Remember how mad we were with him?
Yeah, no, I was one of those occasions when you just sort of clench your teeth and walk and turn around. But he was showing us a horse, guy. He was going to show us a stallion that they were going to take to a stallion show somewhere near here. And he was obviously fairly proud of the horse. He wouldn't have shown it to us. But he went in, opened the box door, slid the door back, and the horse was standing with his back toward him. And it didn't turn around. I sort of mentioned to it that it might turn around quietly.
That's right, you did.
And it didn't seem to want to. So he went in and jerked the horse around, grabbed it by the head collar, halter, and jerked it around. And so that we could see it. And then the horse sort of gently shook its head and nudged him. And he started jerking the head collar. Make him stand still, and that's what he said in a very rough voice, which was calculated not to make any horse stand still. I don't know whether he realizes it or not, but that's sort of, you know, the same way with you and your cow. Well, the tone of voice is what makes a horse move or not move. And the tone of voice he was using was one of reprimand. I mean, he was punishing the horse. Well, now, stallions are intelligent. They're probably more intelligent than, say, your ordinary mare or gelding. And they don't take that sort of thing. They're like thoroughbreds in general. Well, Mr. Holworth said about thoroughbreds in general. He said that they wouldn't take abuse.
Fight back.
They'd fight back. And stallions in general are like that also. They can sense an insult and they won't take it. So the next step that he's probably going to run into if he keeps treating that horse like that is that when he jerks the head collar like that, the horse will bite him. And then he'll hit the horse on the nose, and the next time he tries to hit the horse on the nose, the horse will go up in the air,
mm-hmm.
rear up and come down with his front feet at him. And then they'll say that he's got a vicious day.
Those front feet can be right disastrous, can't they?
Well, I've never been hit by them, but...
That's what they fight with.
That's what they fight with, yeah.
With each other, yeah.
Yeah, with each other. Teeth and feet, yeah. But you see, it's that sort of attitude that head groom has. And it's not really that he's not thinking, that he realizes what he's doing. Because, you see, Miss Davis is, when she's talking about first play, she talks about, she was describing him to us and said, oh, I just couldn't handle him. I couldn't handle that horse. Takes three boys to handle that horse.
That's right.
Well, you see, that's pride. That's not, really being truthful. That's being, saying my staying is bigger and better and stronger than your staying, really. And so they encourage it because, you know, it's the same thing with these, like these riders that talk about how many falls and bucking horses they've ridden.
That's right.
It's sort of pride in the strength of the animal and in their courage and even going near it, you see.
And remember,
but it's a shame.
Yeah. And remember how when I asked Mr. Howard how did he manage to fix First Blaze's feet?
He just shrugged.
Yeah.
He hardly even said anything. He just shrugged. So it's all right. He's all right.
Good horse. Fine horse.
Yeah. About Sunshine Stud.
That's right. He wouldn't.
He wasn't going to say one thing about Sunshine Stud because he knows you know Mrs. Davis.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't going to say a word about Sunshine Stud one way or the other.
Uh-huh.
But you listen to him how he handles his horses. And you listen to him talking about how it was in England. And you know what he thinks.
Yeah.
You know.
On his way out to the car the other day, he said that he'd lost some good jobs. And I said, Mr. Howarth, I can't imagine as good as you are. He said, yeah, he'd lost some good ones. Mostly because they didn't want anybody that they thought knew more than they did.
Yeah.
He was modest about it. He didn't say it proudly.
No, that
was at Monday at breakfast. That's breakfast on Monday the 27th, October 6-9. That's Monday at breakfast, October 27th, 6-9. We didn't talk last night, but didn't say. Now this is supper, Tuesday 28th, 6-9. At supper. Tuesday, 28-69. Weather's cleared first time. We had a nice little session with Emerson at the office and then went shopping at GM Fields. We have to do that over again, that shopping and the thing we talked about on Tuesday night, this Wednesday noon. Those nice passages on Dinsdale. There's a good bit that adds loose ends. I think probably just that one little statement would open up the passages and sort of keep you going. You wouldn't feel pushed. Something, put it that way, you see, something enabled him to reach people. Something enabled him to reach people. His own suffering or something. What passage is it that says that?
He's to the various types of clergymen. And then he says to the latter class, Mr. Dimmesdale, by many of these traits of character naturally belonged, to their high mountain peaks of faith and sanctity he would have climbed, had not the tendency been thwarted by the burden, whatever it might be, of crime or anguish, beneath which it was his doom to totter. It kept him down on a level with the lowest, him the man of ethereal attributes, whose voice the angels might else have listened to and answered. But this very burden it was that gave him the sympathies so intimate with the sinful brotherhood of mankind, so that his heart vibrated in unison with theirs, and received their pain into itself, and sent its own throb of pain through a thousand other hearts, in gushes of sad, persuasive eloquence. He says here that Dimmesdale's torment is what enables him to reach the people. He is experienced it. He's able to recognize it in others, to reach out and appeal, or to see it and use it. Realize it. That it's the sympathy that's what, or the sense of sympathetic minister, but sympathy in it. They see. But in doing that, in being able to reach people like that, he's translating his own sin and torment telling it to the people in his sermons in apparently well at least several of his sermons he says he is a man of it was his genuine, one minute, that's Mr. Dimmesdale gone into the pulpit with the purpose never to come down its steps until he should have spoken words like the above. More than once he had cleared his throat and drawn in a long, deep, tremulous breath, which when sent forth again would come burdened with the black secret of his soul. More than once, nay, more than 100 times, he had actually spoken, but how? He had told his hearers that he was altogether vile, a vile companion of the vilest, the worst of sinners, an abomination, a thing of unimaginable iniquity.
Barbara, that you had ride yesterday.
Linda.
Linda.
Linda Thorne, yeah.
I don't know her. Tell me about her.
Well, she's a little 11-year-old.
Yeah.
And she's one of these tiny, frail-looking little children that you think you could blow over just by touch her and she might fall over, you know. She's sort of like Jean.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit like Jean.
Mm-hmm.
And I used Humphrey Hubert instead of Newton. Because I had a feeling that she was going to be small, and I'm Pussy's just so doggone wide back that they can't get their legs around her.
Oh, yeah.
So broad. So I decided I'd find something narrow.
Mm-hmm.
Hubie was the closest thing that was narrow.
Did you use the pad?
Yeah, I used the bareback pad. I put one of the other pads underneath that. Just see some poor kid on that backbone, you know. Going a bit too far in the other direction, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she got out there, and I put her on the lunge, and Hubie didn't quite understand about it, but if she was kicking, well, he'd go, and he did pretty well. And on the lunge, I could tell what sort of seat she had. She just didn't move.
Oh?
She's the first one I sort of told her to touch her toes, and her leg did not move. She didn't even think that it might supposed to be attached to the hip and go back. You know, most of these kids, when they reach down to touch their toe, their leg goes out behind them.
Oh.
And she just kept that leg right down there. And not only the one she was reaching to touch, she could keep the other one there, too.
Oh.
And I kept thinking, well, this child's only supposed to have had a few lessons at Blake's, you know. She just sat there. She didn't have to fight at all to stay there. She was completely relaxed.
Uh-huh.
And we went through all the sort of exercises on the lunch. I took her out to the menage out there. And we did some work, and the more she rode, the more I could see she's just, not only could she just sit on a horse, Claudia can do that. But she's got a feel. Not once did she jerk that horse around.
That's something.
She just You know, and I watched her halt a few times, and she naturally took up the reins and took up some contact.
Uh-huh.
She must have had, what instruction she had must have been good. She must have been lucky.
Uh-huh.
But she took up contact right away. She didn't ride with this completely loose rein that almost all these other
uh-huh.
kids ride with.
Uh-huh.
And her hands were just, when she wanted to stop, she didn't jerk back.
Mm-hmm.
You hardly saw them move.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there was something, she was having trouble about something, then she, like all children, I mean, she's not
oh,
an
yeah.
accomplished rider, but she does have this ability there.
And
why
did Hubie?
And Hubie just shone.
Really?
She got him, I gave her a stick, and she got him, I said, he's asleep, wake him up. Get him good active walk. And when you get there, I'll tell you. And she got him walking actively, and I said, all right, keep him like that. And it's the same thing at the trot. Keep him so he feels like he wants to go faster. And she did. She couldn't keep it up. She dropped back, but she could get it, and she
uh-huh.
knew when she had it.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, Hubie just brought his head up, tucked his chin in, and, oh, he just looked about 15 years younger.
Thank you.
He looked like he was so proud.
Uh-huh.
And he can move, that little horse.
Yeah, he can.
And not only fast, but he can
yeah,
use himself.
Uh-huh.
And there were a couple times when I just stood there and said, looking at the horse. I just couldn't quite believe it. And she was so pleased, because I kept staring at the horse and saying, I've never seen Hubert like that.
Uh-huh.
And she just beamed.
Uh-huh.
She just as broad a grin on her face.
Uh-huh.
It was
fun. She appreciated Hubert A. Tumford too.
Oh yeah, she thinks he's great. And see, well, for one thing, she said, I asked her if she'd ever done any cantering, and she said, well, they started at Blake's, but I can never get the horse to canter. I said, oh well, don't worry about it, Hubie will canter. And he did. And
he's got a good one.
Yeah, he's got a good smooth canter. I said, you won't have to worry about staying on, he's just smooth as he can be. And so we worked on that for about 5 or 10 minutes, just, you know, sort of off and on. And he'd be just canter on down. Now, of course, she couldn't do anything with him at a canter.
Uh-huh.
All she could do, what I made her do, because she kept stopping him, her hands weren't good yet, was just let the reins go completely and just let him canter.
Uh-huh.
But she could turn him, she could neck rein him and turn him, and keep him cantering on a turn. We had to work some on that. I had to say, all right, now look, make him do it,
mm-hmm.
before she could do it. But she caught on. And her hands weren't good enough for her to keep him still. She kept, when she was getting into a canter,
mm-hmm.
and she would stop him, and she went through a little bit there when she just couldn't get him to canter. And I just said, fine, just get rid of the reins. Just forget you've got him.
Uh-huh.
And just kick him on into it, let him go.
Uh-huh.
And he would canter for her, and she was so pleased. Well, you figure when the reason that she hadn't learned to canter was not that she couldn't sit, but because she couldn't get a horse to go.
Yeah.
It wasn't because she couldn't stay on the horse. It was because she couldn't get the horse to go into a canter. Now, when you've had that sort of experience, even a horse like Hubie seems like magic.
Uh-huh. Now, she was bareback. I mean,
she was just
uh-huh.
today she just, or
uh-huh.
that day she just rode
mm-hmm.
with this
mm-hmm.
pad.
Mm-hmm.
And she could do a lot more now. When she gets the saddle on, she'll go back about, she'll lose a lot of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because you can't sit into a saddle the way you can sit into on a horse. You can't feel it the same
mm-hmm.
way. And so when she said, well, that she had cantered before bareback and had thought it was great, but that she hadn't been able to do it quite the same smooth. And she said same thing about trotting, that she'd never been able to keep it very smooth except when she was riding bareback. And it's quite true. A saddle is artificial. It's stiff. It doesn't move like a horse does.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to learn to sit into a saddle. But she can make a horse do with this riding bareback and feeling. She's got the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it sure showed up in Hebron.
Isn't that cute? Yeah.
And that's what the good rider can do, you see. They change the horse they're on.
That's right.
They change the whole character of the horse.
Oh, really?
He looked 15 years younger. You can't know it until you see it. But instead of going around with his head down and all that mane drooping and looking kind of making him look so sad, he had his neck arched and that mane was beginning to be a little bit of a show. There's some pride there, and he lifted his tail up.
Mm-hmm.
He was a different horse.
Well, now what does Franklin do to Tony?
Well, it's sort of the same thing, except that it's not controlled. This little girl could get on Hubie and get him to get some life into him, get him alive, but she had the sensitiveness to control it. And so Hubie was moving, but he was calm.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't like when the little cookies get on him and gallop him around. He didn't get excited then, but he's not really he doesn't look particularly happy. He just goes.
Mm-hmm.
And when Frank gets on Tony, he creates a sort of his vitality and energy. But he doesn't control it in any way. I mean, he just points the pony and goes. He doesn't try to turn it to anything else except barrel racing, which takes a bit of control.
Cover up, see? I mean, it's determined.
Franklin is the reason that Tony is the way he is, and I can't believe it. He's
so
worked
willing.
With him. Willing, yeah. Now, he's worked with him all right. But he soups him up, in my estimation. He just wants to run. And it may be that Tony likes to play and run.
It just seems to me that that's what Tony's happy doing.
Whether
it's like Molly. I get out there, Molly, and I get her up together and give her that control, but I don't think she's happy doing it. And I much prefer, and I'm happier on Molly, just galloping across the pasture.
Uh-huh.
Now I'll take her out there and work her for hours because I think it's good for her, but I don't think she's happy doing that. I've ridden horses who loved it.
Uh-huh.
Missy
probably would.
You'll find that she does.
Yeah. But Molly's not happy that way. And Tony wouldn't be happy that way. He loves to run. He's got...
I think that's it, Bob.
There's a sort of freedom, free spirit there. And Molly's got it, too.
And I think that's what...
And a horse loves to run.
Right.
Well, some horses do, at any rate. They love to... Some horses just love to move.
That's what they're made for, to run.
Yeah. It's instinctive in them.
This is what Nick loves in Molly.
Yeah.
That go business.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm. He doesn't get out and run her, but
he loves the fact that
she wants to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Tony's the same way. Tony's not as demanding about it, though. Tony is perfectly willing to walk. He's not like Molly. Is a bit demanding. She's you get on her and she demands that, you know, she'll keep doing this. Foxtrot and all sorts of other things if you don't let her go.
Well, now look, Barbara, Cookie never would maintain that a stallion's mean.
No, I don't suppose he would. I don't know whether he would or not.
No,
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Because after all, he's never said that Tony was mean because he was a stallion.
No.
Never.
He's mean because his daddy let him get in some bad habits, and
yeah.
He bit.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't handled.
Yeah, wasn't handled. He never said it was because he was stunned.
No.
No. Only thing he ever said about that was that he couldn't have a stallion around the children, an untrained, and they couldn't handle him. The children couldn't handle him. Now, after he had been gelded, then of course they did handle him, but I don't think he blamed that. I think it's just a matter of handling. I think you're right.
Yeah. And he never, at least he's never said anything so direct as that.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
But now you think the common attitude down at some of the farms, horse farms, even the horse farms, is that?
Well, these people at the horse farms, they have a lot of, ran into a lot of nasty experiences with stallions.
I think it's true. I mean, as you go, you know, no foregone conclusion. That's nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You put me off. You interrupted me. These horses come off the track, and they're wound up, and they're tight, and they live a life that's exacting. It's not in any way sort of nothing to break the routine for them ever, except the racing, which is competitive and brings out the pride in them. And a horse like that, you can run into some nasty experiences with him. It doesn't take much to set him off.
That's right.
Something like this groom at Sunshine, who's, when he was showing us the horse, a young stallion. He was pretty proud of the horse. They were taking it to a stallion show. He said he wanted to show it to us. And he went up and opened the box door, and the horse was standing with its back end toward us. And the horse was pretty quiet. The horse was just standing there with his ears on. He wasn't droopy. He was just
quiet.
Very, very quiet. And he wasn't paying much attention. And I spoke to him, and he didn't even flick an ear at me. And I didn't go into him. I wasn't afraid of him, but I just didn't know whether the groom had that idea in mind or not when he showed him to us. But anyway, the groom went in and sort of jerked the horse around, and the horse objected and started shaking its head, and the groom, just to stop him, just kept jerking on the head collar, jerking on his nose. The horse didn't seem to be very upset about it. That particular horse didn't. I don't know. He looked maybe, I don't know whether he was doped or not. If they were taking him to a stallion sale, I don't know. They might have given him a tranquilizer. It's possible.
He was young.
Because he was a young horse. I just can't see him being that, all that quiet. But maybe he was. Maybe that was his natural temperament.
Well, I believe the groom said that they had worked on him, washed him down, and done all sorts
they'd
of things.
Been,
they'd
doing
been working on
him
all day. No, he didn't.
He didn't look clean. He didn't look like they'd worked on him for 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
But he just kept, you know, sort of roughing his head around like that. Well, now you take a horse like Blay, who's got all that magnificent strength and power and pride. Every movement he makes is full of this, just full of himself. And I don't know, it seems to me if a groom started anything with him, he might fight back. I mean, he doesn't seem like he'd be an easy horse to handle by any means.
Well, now, Barbara, a groom wouldn't even jerk this other stallion's halter.
You mean Blay?
Now the other one.
The one he was showing.
Without somebody setting the pace for him, the trainer or somebody.
Well, it's pretty common attitude, you see. Well, if you have a few bad experiences, it's so easy to make a general rule, you know. And you have a few bad experiences with maybe a horse like Blay, who fights back at the least thing, or who just maybe wants to run and can't be held, or something like that. And pretty soon you get to thinking, well, all stallions are like this.
Could be this groom had had some unhappy experiences physically.
He probably had.
Mm-hmm.
Most grooms who work with horses do, even if they work with mares and geldings. I've had some unhappy experiences. But the attitude, you see, is that a mare or gelding, you don't fight back. I mean, if a horse bites you, you punish him. But you don't expect him to bite you. Whereas with the stallion, it's a bit different. Now, you see, because they're one class of horse.
That's right. And because they are maybe smarter in the overall.
Yeah, and because, well, they're more sensitive.
Yes.
More sensitive, so they respond more quickly to things like that.
So that would be, looking at it clearly, yes, I could see that.
And it becomes very easy to get an attitude like that. Of course, once a trainer or somebody like that has it, once the boss has it, then your grooms pick it up. It's easy. I picked up attitudes and bad attitudes in stables.
Is that in those little articles, that attitude?
Yeah, oh yeah, it's in them. There's one trainer, the trainer of Dr. Fager says that for me, you're at a general rule about stallions that he tells all of his men. Is that familiarity breeds contempt on the stallion's part?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's a man that's proud of his horses, and he's sensitive to what his horses need. Otherwise, he never would have treated Dr. Fager any differently from any other stallion by turning him loose in his paddock earlier. Or anything like that.
Well, it was the right civilized approach they had to Dr. Fager, wasn't it? Sort of gradual unminding and the like.
Yeah, the approach is civilized. But, you know, it's so easy to do things. Do the right things physically. Like taking your time and all that, and yet have a different attitude about it. For instance, he says, "What was it? All that the whole routine sounds good, but there's one part where he says if you go in with Dr. Fager, that you have to punch him between the eyes before he bites you." Well, I've met some horses that if you punched them in the eyes before they bite you, they just bite you again.
You have to be prepared to do that.
Yeah, he says you have to be ready.
Uh-huh.
And when you go into the paddock, the minute he tries to bite you, you punch him between the eyes. Well, I don't know. I poor old Dr. Fager might be scratching a mosquito. I don't know. You figure a few times somebody's going to miss. They're going to hit him when he wasn't going to do anything.
Well, now, how would you work in a stable like that, Barbara, yourself? Would you be in the stable and go your own way?
Well, you can't. You can try. Chances are you won't last very long.
Attitudes of catching.
Yeah. I mean, even if I were to work in a stable like that long enough, pretty soon I'd be treating horses in the same manner. I've done it before. I can't help it. You get in a yard and somebody says, Well, now, if that horse runs out of the stall at you, just pick up the stick beside, just carry a stick with you, and if that horse runs out of the stall at you, lay it one over the nose, and it'll never do it again. It'll learn its lesson. And you still have to do it 3 or 4 times later, but you don't think about it, because you know, you think, oh, well, it's got to know. The horse has got to know.
So you don't try to
You aren't figuring out another way. You're figuring this is the way to teach it. And I'm sure that's where we missed with that mare.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's where we missed.
What was
that case? That horse that tilts. the little mare that was so doggone intelligent and proud that she thought she was queen of the yard and queen of her box. And she would fight anything that challenged that. And see, before she came to us, she'd never been challenged. She'd always had her way. No matter what she wanted to do, she'd always had her way. From the time she was a baby to the time she was 4 or 5 years old and strong in the height of her strength.
Isn't that amazing?
And when she got to us and had to do, you see, the things that we've made her do, she fought. And she never stopped fighting. They had to put her down. Now, somewhere we made a mistake with that horse.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere I made a mistake with her because I was her groom. And it was because I was told, don't let her get by with a thing.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't.
Well, isn't that what we're all told? If a horse wants to go to the right, make him go to the left.
Yeah. It's what we're all told, but somewhere, when you meet that sort of intelligence, you've got to give to it.
Mm-hmm. And find out.
And find out another way. And see, I didn't. And in the end, that horse had to be destroyed. And I'm always going to feel guilty about it. See, you would say it was her nature, that she would have been like that to anybody that forced her to do her will.
Mm-hmm.
Their will. But, well, I wasn't groom all the time with the horse.
Mm-hmm.
There was another. I was groom half the time. Another girl groomed it the other half. And I could always handle her. She wouldn't do anything with me. She would try it, but she never really would do it. She wouldn't keep it up. She understood that if I stopped her once, she couldn't try again the same day. She could try again another day, but not the same day. But somewhere I missed on that horse. Somewhere I missed where. See, if she tried to bite me, I'd hit her on the nose. That's the standard procedure. You punish immediately, and that's the quickest way. It's like slapping a child's, you know, hand or something like that. It's not going to hurt the horse and damage the horse permanently unless it's mine that's damaged. If she tried to kick me, she was punished immediately. Any of these things she tried, she was punished for immediately. And she just got so doggone frustrated that her attempts to get back became wilder and wilder. And I think that's what happens with stallions. I'm sure it's what happens. Now there's some people, of course, the attitude of the tilts was that this was a child's pony who must obey, because it is a child's pony. But the discipline of a horse that's going to, intended for use by a child must be strict.
Mm-hmm.
You can't afford to let them get by with something and then have a child suffer because of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know somehow that if that horse had been in a different situation, she could have been persuaded rather than forced. Which is it's not a wholly different approach, but it takes longer, and you can't be forced by what somebody else thinks about how a horse should be trained. That's when you work with a horse that way, it's got to be purely intuition.
Oh yeah.
And in a stable like the tilt. Where you take in horses and train them by the not by a set pattern. You vary the pattern to fit the horse, but occasionally, like in schools, there's going to come a horse that's different. Just like in schools, there comes a child that's so different that they don't fit the system. And I think that mare was that way. And I think what happens to her is what happens to Stallion. I think it's the same attitude on both sides. It's clashing. Well, these big farms don't have time.
They don't have time. It almost has to be institutional, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's
the
way they are.
Uh-huh.
They don't have the time. They don't have the grooms. And they don't have the grooms that... Not enough of them and not enough interest. Takes a special kind of touch to handle that sort of mind, that sort of temperament in an animal.
Now, who was this groom that had the touch? Up at Mr. Daly's farm? Mr.
Oh, Colby, yeah. He's probably the only groom in this country I've seen that had a real feel for a horse that I would have trusted a stallion with. Though I don't know, I've never seen him around a stallion. See, he might have prejudices that I don't know about.
But you can hardly imagine it.
But I can't imagine it, no. He's got so much love of horses, so much feel for them. And he's working now because he loves them, not because he needs some money. The woman that owned the stable before the Dalys bought it left him enough money to live on for the rest of his life. She left him a permanent income.
That's unusual, isn't it?
And he's still working with horses because he loves it.
And he's no longer young.
No, he's an old man. He's one of the last, Mr. Daly calls him the last of the old breed of Negro grooms.
Yeah.
And he's proud of his horses.
Oh, yeah. He loves to talk about his saddle horses, the champions he took to shows, the groomed. And talk about days when a groom was proud of how good his horse looked. He knows it's no longer true. And he can switch, you see. He's worked with saddle horses all his life. All these show horses that take, he said he'd spend all day on a horse. Start in the morning and spend all day just getting one horse ready. Well, because it takes so much care to take care of a saddle horse for a show. And he would just work and work and work and work on one horse. But when he got through, he was proud of what he had. And he'd send it into a show ring. He'd stand out with the other grooms. They used to stand around the entrance of a show ring just to watch their horses go.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Says he used to stand out by the, you know, they go around the groom's quarters and they talk and they talk about their horses. They used to anyway.
Well, I guess I thought they all did, even now, because I see those beautiful horses. I can't imagine not being proud of them.
Well, they do, but he's in touch with a different generation. You see,
yeah.
Most people nowadays want to be riders, you see,
mm-hmm.
or owners. They like your Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to even put a brush to a horse. They want to have somebody else do that for them.
Oh, no, that's right. Oh, you. No groom.
No, he no good.
No.
Well, you see, that's the way even the Negro boys feel now. Grooming's a boy's job, and they're men, you see. And grooming's not a job for a man. They don't want to be called boy, you know. It's the same thing. All these things they used to be to do and be proud of doing, they connect, and they just don't want to do anymore. Won't it?
Well, I think I must be just a menial after all. I love to brush a horse.
Well, I do too.
I just love to groom a horse.
One of the only time I wasn't really, really happy at tilts was I always had one horse, and I used to miss not having three to do. I used to go out and just work on this one horse for an hour and a half in the morning. Just, she was worth it though. She was pretty. But I rode her, I schooled her. But I used to love to just, even I didn't have the energy to go out and put a saddle on her, but I'd go out and brush her and just work on her. And we'd talk. And it was quite a few, after you worked with him that long, almost all of us would feel that was the best part of the day was when we were in grooming. Not riding, but grooming.
Yeah.
But you see how yeah, that's right, she did. She made Blade into a hellion. And that's, I think, maybe a...
Right. I just thought, I wasn't sure you were serious. I didn't realize you'd gone and taped over the other one.
Hand it to him now.
Where did we meet this groom in the first place?
We met him. I don't know. We would look. We asked where first play was.
That's
he
right.
told us, and he
That's
was
right.
wandering down the.
That's right.
Down the line of boxes. I don't know what he was doing.
That's right.
And when we came back, we went down to see for Blay.
Yeah, that's right.
No, we didn't go see him. We just wanted to make sure.
Oh!
You asked where if the horse in that paddock was.
Ways and Means
ways
was in
and
the
means.
Wrong paddock. That's right.
Yeah.
That's where it started. And
yeah.
I said, isn't that Ways and Means? And he said, yes, they'd moved him to the front paddock.
Yeah, they'd moved
him to
the front.
And I said, and Blay doesn't have his name up, and he didn't. Well, anyway.
Yeah.
That was Ways.
And then he said, since we seemed to be interested in two out of the three stains, he decided he'd show us the third one, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But he said that they were taking this horse to, we started from the wrong thesis. I'm not going to be able to get mad properly.
That's right.
That's right.
Let's start on about that article.
That's right.
Well, it's kind of hard to get mad last night. This is Thursday night. About bedtime, the 20th of October, 69, channel 1 over 6:30, channel 1 over 6:30, Thursday night, about bedtime, 30th of October, 69, and there's a little patching up to do, a passage in the colored groom up the country who can spend all day grooming and work, you see, but that's doesn't say anything, there's no information there. And there's what made me think about that, I got the notice of the Calabool Seal, and they have the points about judging, if that's got anything to do with grooming a horse. That's where I fouled up last year, cost me money. We need one or two passages in which Ishmael's fairly clear. We've started off and have one or two little pictures of Donald.
Or routine plus 15 million other things. That bit about working all day on one horse I got from another girl, actually, who worked with seven horses. And she said she quit because she would work all day on one horse and she felt she wasn't getting anywhere. She might spend a little more time with some of the others. She said she used to spend all day on one horse and the next day she'd have to do it all over again.
Well, what in the world happens to spend one day on a whole horse?
Well, with saddle horses now, like Kobe would have to start out, you'd have to start out with getting, with just brushing and picking out the feet and brushing the horse. And you know, you have to go through about three different kinds of brushes to get a horse really properly brushed. That takes an hour right there, just brushing.
Barbara?
No, I'm not joking. You start off with one of those brushes, little stiff brushes like you've got. And then you go over them with a soft dandy brush. And you just work on them with that.
Is that to get the sand out? Everything?
Yeah. Good. The dandy brush, the hard brush gets the sand out. And the soft brush gets the grease and oil out, which is why you shouldn't use it on horses like yours.
Soft brush?
Yeah.
Should never use it on horses, our horses.
Not horses that are out.
Oh.
Because it takes the oil out of the coat. But
oh.
you use it on horses that are kept in.
I never knew that. So
yeah.
The thing for us to use is the...
Well, what you got.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you got. But,
what do we got?
You've got the stiff brushes. It's the stiff...
Yeah, just for the sand.
Yeah, it just gets the worst of the dirt out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you go over them with all that sort of stuff, and then you go over them with a... You tell you, well, what Kobe does, he wads up a one of these stable rubbers.
Stable rubbers?
Yeah, they're linen.
Yeah.
They're a linen towel. A lot of people use them for dish towels. And they can get them. But he wads one of those up and makes his banger out of that. The English grooms go through all this stuff weaving straw into and weave it up into a oval. And that's what they use as a banger.
It's a banger.
Yeah, you just take it and you hit the horse as hard as you can with it. And just in sort of down the muscles, it's a sort of massage. I've seen Kobe do that many a time. After he gets through brushing him, he just goes over him with this, puts all his arm into it.
Oh.
Tiring.
Just
yeah.
Banging.
It's not right into the horse. It's with the muscle, you
uh-huh.
see. That you're going like down the neck muscles and the shoulder muscles, and you don't use it on the sides. Use it on the neck and the shoulders and the quarters, all where those flat muscles are. Just hard as you can. You can keep that up for about 5 or 10 minutes if you're any good. I never did. But you know Kipling's thing. Kipling has the army routine in one of his. One of his soldiers goes around muttering, cursing it out. About how long he has to, because there was a limit of time they had to spend on each doggone little thing. They couldn't spend anything less than 15 minutes on one section of the horse doing one thing. And then after you get through with all that, if you're doing the sort of work like Kobe did, when getting a horse ready for a show, then he had to start dealing with the mane and tail. And it takes a long time to brush out a tail. You use a soft brush and you just keep going at every individual little hair till every hair is separate. Every hair has to be clean. I mean, if it's dirty, you have to wash it, shampoo it, and then let it dry. And then you have to go through it and brush it, make sure that every hair is separate and not tangled. And you do the same thing on the mane. And then with these saddle horses, you see, what you've got to do is you go back and you've got to put that false tail on.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they aren't going to be shown, then they've got to have a brace on to hold the tail in place. And the hooves have to be taken care of with oil and well, I don't know, we used to have to wash ours out with soda and water. Wash the hooves out. And then they should have been oiled after that.
Good.
By the time you got through with all that, you can see how you take it. That would take
yeah.
a couple of hours.
And then when you have to plait some of the mane.
Plaiting takes about, well, for saddle horses now, all they do is plait one plait
mm-hmm.
with 5 gated horses. 3 gated horses' manes are roached, like Missy's. But the 5 gated horses and Tennessee walking horses have this one plait. It's got the ribbon, 3 different colors of ribbon in it. Now all that has to be plaited in with it and arranged. Hunters have to have their tails braided.
Mm-hmm.
Or they used to. They don't anymore. That's gone out. And I found out something that really startled me in England. The English hunters' tails are not braided. You braid show hacks' tails, but never braid a hunter. Well, of course, the hunter's the only thing we braid.
Isn't that interesting?
I was so startled. But that takes a while. In a hunter, the mane is pulled, and that's just a sort of an odd job. Anytime you've got 5 or 10 minutes to spare, to pull a horse's mane or tail.
Pull it.
Yeah, you don't cut it. You pull the hair out.
Yeah,
a little mane cone, and you just go up the mane, jerking the hair out. Of course, it doesn't hurt him. Until you get it about 4 or 5 inches long and all even. And then when you have to braid it, it's easy to braid. You leave it long, like you can't braid it very well. And you that hurts, that does, braiding.
Uh-huh.
My hands can I can do about 2 braids before my hands are just crunched. Up the little bits, yes. I just get cramps in them.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the one horse, the hunter in this country, you do anywhere from 15 to 21 braids. In England, you're only supposed to do 5 or something like that.
That's nice.
That was the most information I've had.
His Uncle Dylan? That's.
Yeah.
That's the one.
Put that in. That's not on.
No, the gun shop in Moorhead is
now he's been working on this shop. I haven't been able to talk to him about anything that's happened to him except what's going on right now. He gets so involved in it. But it gets him out, he sees people we never even knew existed in Nash County. I wouldn't say we knew many people existed, but he sees them. He goes into these hardware places and he starts asking around for old machinery, you know, what everybody else would think was junk. And they'll say, well, so-and-so's got a motor or lathe or whatever it is he's asking after. And one of the people that they said had some equipment was Joe Dillon. And so Don went over to see him. And he's an old man, about 90, I think, something like that, 80s and 90s. He's just about given up doing any work. He makes, at the moment, he's making truck beds. But he's a blacksmith. And in his younger days, he used to make wagon wheels. So Donald got talking with him about making wagon wheels. And within a day or so, it wasn't Mr. Dillon anymore. It was Uncle Joe. And Don says he figured out that the only way you can work with Uncle Joe is you go in and you say, Mr. Dillon, folks around here say that you know one that knows how to make wagon wheels around here. And you just have to keep sort of playing to him like that. He's the one that knows how to do it. And just give him a lead like that and let him follow it. And pretty soon he took Donald out to the back and he said, now you want to make wagon wheels, son, I'll sell you, I've got 2 of these things, but I'll sell you one of them. And he showed one to Don, and it was a copy lathe for making the spokes. And it was rigged up with a sander. And the sander wasn't one of your old common ordinary sanders on a flat surface, like most of them are. It was on 3 triangles, 3 different wheels. And you could, if you wanted a flat surface, you could put it on the bottom, and you could sand your flat surface. But if you wanted to do something like a wagon spoke, put it on the edge and push it in, and the belt would go to the shape, you see. Just however far you pushed it in, that was what the shape you'd get. So you could sand a round object as well as you could a flat one. And he said he had one of those dismantled back in the back. He'd sell that to Don. So Don's got some, that little bit stashed away for his shop. But these people just make anything you see that he didn't have. Any machine that he couldn't buy, or if what he could buy he didn't think would work very well, he'd just make his own. Just work it out.
But now Donald's taste in loudspeakers. You were talking about that.
We have jumped, haven't we? He likes too much bass for me, that's what it is. He's got this stereo set that he thinks is really great.
Robert.
No, this is a record player. It's he bought some speakers for it, which he paid. I think the speakers cost more than the amplifier and record deck, I'm not sure. And he sets those things up, and he plays, he likes this deep bass on it, and that's fine with me. It's great. But there's something about those speakers that just doesn't pick up the treble. They just don't pick it up right for me. I mean, I can put on a record of Chrysler or something like that. And as far as I'm concerned, the reproduction is not good. But my brother puts on something, an organ recital, and turns the bass up so that I have to leave the room because I just can't stand the vibrations. And he thinks the reproduction is great. So, I don't know. But he agrees with me. He agrees with me that the Dead's Hi-Fi is the best speaker he's ever heard. And it's the best sound he's ever heard, even on stereo. I mean, you know, these high-priced stereos. Mm-hmm. But Dad knows.